The following is Chris Risden's feature talk, Shaping Behavior by Design, from the 2016 UX Immersion Interactions Conference.
Today, I want to leverage a little bit the theme yesterday around prototyping, but really thinking broadly about our process and our making, you know, the things that we output and the process that we have and the activities we do to get to our designs, and start connecting that a little bit more significantly to behavior and like the behavioral sciences and having a deeper understanding of how people think, how people make decisions, what the biases they have, and understanding what it means to actually leverage that. I think we do it a lot, but I think we kind of do it accidentally or without a lot of rigor, and I want to see if we can push that. And then, you know, this is a UX conference. Most of you guys are in some way related to UX, if not identifying as UX designers, but this is UX Immersion's interactions. So I'm also going to kind of use interaction design as the lens among the many skills as UX generalists we might have in research and in strategy and in IA or usability. I'm going to talk about how interaction design is going to be a critical discipline to level ourselves up in among those many disciplines we have to better utilize applying in a practical way the behavioral sciences. But first, I'm going to start with a story, a made-up story, kind of a scenario of sorts. So I imagine it's 2004. So it's old-timey days before airport Wi-Fi, before mobile phones, or at least the smartphones that we have now. And in this scenario, you're at an airport, and let's say it's like a two-hour layover, so you've got time to kill. You have the time to kill, and so you go to an airport bar, you sidle up to the bar to have a beer. You know, they usually have sports or news on, and in this case, there's news. And actually, in this case, there's breaking news. And in 2004, this breaking news is the Indonesian tsunami that hit from the Indian Ocean earthquake in 2004. And so this is a breaking story, and it's really tragic. You see the death toll, the chaos, all of a sudden they're talking about 10,000 dead, then 5 minutes later it's 30,000 dead, and then 20 minutes later it's 70,000 dead. And your heart sort of goes out to these people halfway around the world. And you kind of have this sympathy for them. And so you're listening to the story, and you kind of always, you know, in the back of your mind, it was kind of like, what can I do? I mean, this is really awful. And so one of the calls to action you see is, well, if you can do anything, donate to the Red Cross. If there's one way you can help, that's going to help. They need the supplies, the blood, the funds to do that. And you're like, that sounds like a good idea. I should donate to the Red Cross. Well, again, old-timey days in 2004, what do you have to do? Well, you're at the airport, and you have to think, well, okay, so I'm prompted. I'm like, I should do that. Someone asked me to donate to the Red Cross, I'll do that. Then I had to make that mental note. All right, so later when I get a chance, I'll donate to the Red Cross. And then, well, time passes, I get on my flight, I get home, I walk my dog, check my mail. Maybe I'll remember it, and maybe I'll turn on the TV and see the story again, but now all of a sudden I've got other things going on. But if I decide to do it, then, well, I have to get online and go to redcross.org, and then basically it's kind of like a typical e-commerce funnel. I have to enter billing information, my address. And then the hardest decision of all, not necessarily ironically, but kind of interestingly, is I have to make a decision here. How much do I want to donate? I could donate $100 because I want to feel like I'm actually contributing, right? But that's actually a lot of money that I'm not sure I want to part with. So, I don't know, $10, $20, is that even worth it? It's just so little money. So you have what is kind of a typical funnel, right? You might have a call to action go out and 100 people say, like, that's a good idea, I should do that. At every stage, there's a little bit of drop-off, a little bit of drop-off, and you might be lucky if you get 5 people to actually follow up on that commitment, if they're just somewhat motivated and then they get distracted. So let's think about that scenario, but now let's go down to 2010. And in this case, you have the same situation. You've got the time, it's a layover, you go to the airport bar, sidle up to the bar, there's a news story, and again, sadly, it's a tragic story that's unfolding, it's breaking news, and you go there. And in this case, in 2010, it's the Haitian earthquake. And so you're seeing these images again, you're seeing the story develop, right? There's rubble, there's bodies, and there's death, and there's the chaos and disorganization. And your heart goes out to these people again, and again you think, like, well, what could I do? And again, there's a call to action, right? You know, donate to the Red Cross if you can do anything. And so in this case, in 2010, you have a little bit of a different situation. How many people recognize this number? A few? Yeah, so this is 90999. This is the text messaging service that lets you donate to the Red Cross. All you have to do is basically get on your phone, enter that text number, put in what cause you're doing, and technically you don't even have to do that, but that helps to know where you want the money to go. They'll confirm, that's what you want to do, and they'll automatically take $10 out of your next phone bill. So all of a sudden now, when I'm really thinking, like, this is something I want to do, I can even take an old-timey flip phone, and I can do this where I can have it, and I don't have to think about the money. I don't, you know, it's $10, everyone, I don't have to compare myself to other people. If other people do this, they're donating $10. We're all in it together. I'm not even going to see the money. I probably even have the phone bill on auto pay, so I'm not even going to notice that $10 happen. And most importantly, I was most motivated when I was seeing those images, and then they prompted me to do that when they said you should donate, and I was actually able to donate at that time. And it seems really simple, and it almost seems remedial, but it was actually pretty powerful stuff. In a Pew follow-up survey, they find out that 43 million raised money via mobile texting for the Haitian relief. And what's really interesting, though, is that most of these donations were made on impulse. So basically, when they saw that prompt, and I'm seeing these images, and I'm really motivated to do it. And their interest in Haiti's recovery quickly waned. They really didn't follow up much. I'm sure it was on the news, but again, kind of like getting home from the airport, you get distracted, and you have other things. What those two things mean, those second and third bullets, is that from that 43 million, if they couldn't donate at that time when they were prompted, that money wouldn't have come in. So most of that money is probably, in a sense, new money on top of what other people might donate. And then as far as saying, like, can this be sort of a new behavior that kind of gets ingrained in how we operate, over half of the donors made text message contributions to other relief efforts. For example, the nuclear reactor incident in Japan a couple years ago. So that's pretty powerful stuff. I picked that one because I think it has a lot of impact, but it exists all around us, right? If you've ever seen, you know, you swipe your card at the point of sale and it says, you know, do you want to donate $1, $2, or $3 to some like military benefit or ASPCA or cancer research fund? And it's like, yeah, what's a dollar? I already swiped my card, I'm spending $32, what's $3? And so we're all of a sudden, if we're aligning this, we can actually influence behaviors by thinking about how these things can actually be enabled. And so that's leveraging behavioral science, whether we think about doing it explicitly or not. That's basically our systematic analysis of investigation human behavior. But what it really is a collection of disciplines in academic and research, like such as behavioral economics, behavioral psychology, there's neural, there's cognitive, there's all these things that over the past 20 years and more, longer, but really relevant to us, have been developing. And what I'm looking for is, like, what is the gap in saying, like, how do we consciously apply that in our work where we're touching so many consumers with our products and services? And one of the best analogies I have to sort of convey what that looks like is documentary filmmaking. And at the turn of the century, after they got used to the novelty of, like, actually running a camera so they'd fix it in some place to watch, like, people coming out of a church or people coming in, you know, filing into work, the main form of filmmaking was basically filming a stage play, right? You had the tableau of the stage, it was a scripted play, let's just film that. And you can kind of, like, scale distribution by taking that and showing it to other people. And so documentary filmmaking came a little bit after that, and that seemed, like, really interesting, like, oh, gosh, you know, editorial filmmaking. And it was thought of as kind of this objective, you know, form of filmmaking where they called it life as it is, like a reflection of what was happening and a factual film which is dramatic. You know, we know now, we're pretty savvy to know that, like, every decision a filmmaker makes, especially when we're talking about nonfiction work, who they decide to film, what they ask those people or what those people say, where they shoot and what location, how they edit it, obviously, what music they put to it, the fact that they have framed it into an hour or 5 hours or 3 hours, the story that's actually probably expansive, all those elements actually affect how we, the audience, receive and perceive that story, right? You hear things like, well, that was taken out of context and things like that. So we know that documentary filmmaking is actually a bunch of decisions that influence our perception of the story being told. And as designers, I don't think it's any different. I think every design decision we make influences the user. In some cases, that's very benign or benevolent in what we do. Like, we want to use smart defaults in a form so that we help people along to, you know, complete the task that they're having because we know this is likely what their decision could be. But that's a decision, and that's a decision that influences the user. And then doing things like point-of-sale stuff, that's decisions, and that influences the user. So, you know, one of the terms from behavioral economics in Fowler and Sunstein's book Nudge was a choice architecture. And, you know, that's organizing the context in which people make decisions. And that's, I think, kind of reflective of what we do, sometimes with real intent to influence people and sometimes not. But we're doing that filmmaker work. We're editing. We're making decisions. We're deciding what design patterns to use and how they influence. We think about things, particularly from interaction design, like framing and affordances and feedback and feed forward. And we are making decisions and essentially editing what happens so that we can see how we influence people's behavior. So a popular thing from the behavioral economics case studies is the idea of rearranging and reconfiguring a cafeteria. You know, if you're a large employer, you have thousands of employees. In their best interest, you want them to make better dietary decisions. So you label things in a certain way, you move the sweets, make them harder to get, you move the healthy stuff up front, you make all these little decisions, the choice architecture, and you're not necessarily being what they'd call paternalistic, meaning you're not trying to be a complete nanny state in that you're taking away choices, you're architecting the choices. I can still get the sweets if I'm motivated. And this is really interesting, but it's also thinking about, you know, and this is the case studies you often hear if you want to go and research behavioral psychology and think about how to apply it to design. And it's fascinating, but it also doesn't scale really well. And we live, most of the people in this room live in a world where they're designing products and services that have to go at scale into the market. So it's telling, though. What it means is, you know, the cafeteria case study and many others like it is that the changing the environment is actually the most impactful way to influence behavior. Other little ways, like if they say, like, oh, I don't want to keep charging on my credit card. Well, someone will say, put it in a block of ice in the freezer. That way you've changed your environment in that it's not actually on your person when you go out into the world, and you have to go to all this effort if you really do need to use it. It means you'll have to be motivated. There has to be a good reason for it. So changing the environment is the most impactful way to change behavior. But as I said, we work generalizing. We that do consumer products and services in the enterprise and for consumers that in the app store, in software, and web. We're working at a certain scale where we can't go and keep rearranging everyone's environment. We work in a world where our products and services live in an environment over which we have little control. We might be able to accompany them in that environment by being in their pocket, so to speak, but we can't necessarily control the environment. So if we want to think about influencing behavior, or if we at least want to think about what our power is so we are responsible in potentially influencing behavior, we have to think, like, what is in our control? What do these things lend themselves in interaction design and in UX design and design in general? Well, we can influence how people perceive the environment. That might be simply framing something in a certain way, or it might be literally, like using augmented reality. We can influence how people navigate the environment, again, sort of to a certain extent, like, oh, here are the steps you should take. Let's foreground that. Oh, okay, I might want to do that. Or maybe literally, like we're mapping what people should do. We can influence how people interact with the environment. And so these are the things that should start to relate, like, yeah, I have a certain competency or capacity to think about these things because I'm understanding behavior because I do research and I'm understanding interaction patterns and design patterns that I understand can influence people. So I'm trying to make that connection of, like, if I want to influence behavior, or at least I want to be aware of the influence I can have on behavior, in what lens am I looking through to be able to do that? Because I can't go and rearrange their cafeteria. I can't rearrange their home. I can't necessarily take away the temptations they might be walking around and things like that. And so in a crude, overly reduced, and overly simplified way of like thinking about where we've come from technology design, interaction design, processing allowed us to do things better, like, you know, do our spreadsheets and do our documents better, and then we were able to make that faster, and we make that a little bit portable through laptops. And then connectivity actually allowed us to be connected to things, and so we went from, even though they still exist, productivity apps to apps like your Facebook and your Netflix. I want to be connected to my movies, I want to be connected to my email, I want to be connected to my music, you know, through iTunes, and all of a sudden those can go with us. And now what we have is the sensors that literally live in our person. The connectivity, the processing, and the sensors are added to the mix, and they're with us, right? They're on our wrists, they're in our pocket, in our phones. And what you notice then, going from, you know, spreadsheets to being connected to really interesting social things in our life to being connected to us, is that literally the closer technology gets to us physically, the more it becomes about us. And a simple way, we can sit there and look at extremes, but a simple way is to think, like, before, calendars were about your appointments, right? The events that were happening. And they're kind of like that still, but now all of a sudden, because calendars can access other apps, calendars can do geolocation with the sensors, they're actually trying to be smart and trying to optimize, and it's really about your behavior, and it's about, let's not be about your events, let's about maximizing your time and taking opportune moments, and the events, we're going to be smart about the events so that the events don't seem like a burden. So even now that the calendar's in our pocket and it's got more sensors and it's got more connectivity, the calendar is more about us and like what we have and our time versus tracking and being connected to your actual appointments. So most of these features, most of this idea of influence usually exists at the micro level, meaning like they're features and instances, they're really good at spurring conversion, they're really good at spurring onboarding, and they're those types of things. A good example of this, obviously Microsoft OneClick, right? They've taken the friction away from shopping of going through the checkout carts, and if you've done retail, you know that that's like that funnel, right? You know, every little piece of friction is going to have some effect on people whose commitment is going to wane a little bit. And so if we take that away, will you buy it? And they love it because, you know, they want you to buy more things. And you might like it because it's actually kind of convenient. And then there's another psychological principle happening in there as well. If I normally go through the typical checkout process, I've put something in there that's $30, I've put something in there that's $20, I've put something in there that's $50, and then I have to decide to spend $100. And it's like, do I want these things? Well, maybe I'll take this one thing out because I think $50 or $70 is more palatable. Here, it's psychologically much easier if I buy something for $20, because that's just $20. Then if I buy something for $30, because that's just $30. And if I buy something for $50, versus seeing them all together for $100. So there's a few things that work here, but it's at this feature level, right? It's trying to spur conversion. But it's also making something convenient for us. Now we have products that are sort of at the macro level, the actual products or services, behavior change. You know, those are going to be obvious from your Nest and your Jawbones and Fitbits and budgeting apps and getting out of debt. And if we look at this on a scale from kind of thinking about influence and persuasion, which can be kind of scary words when we're thinking about designing, it's not binary. It's on a spectrum. And actually, where it lands on that spectrum is pretty much going to be defined by the intent of the people designing or implementing those services. But if we were to sit there and think about another dimension, which is the transparency, like to what extent do you know that this thing is designed to change your behavior? And so you might have things that are on the utility side of the spectrum where we're not trying to, you know, really influence you. You might have some influence, maybe like those smart defaults, but we're not trying to. Versus on the other side where it's like, yeah, we want to influence you. But we're also saying like, hey, we want to influence you. We're saying that out loud. You know, you have the things that were more about being connected products, right? Like, you know, iTunes is going to connect you to your music. It's not going to tell you how to make a playlist or what to do with that music. You know, same thing with your images, same thing with your emails. These are utilities, these are tools to allow you to, in theory, do things your way. Obviously, within the limits of what features and what capabilities they want to support. Then some things, like kind of like that smart calendar and other things like that, where they might start to move a little bit because they are doing some selective editing. Right, we know like certain things like, well, we don't think we should just support all the features. We're going to support these features, and that's going to have some influence, fairly benign, but you know it. Like they'll sit there and say it, like what you're doing. That's why it's kind of above the line. But then all the micro things, like they don't declare a value proposition. They don't try to say what they're trying to do. So this is where they sort of live, you know, under the sea, so to speak. But they're often not trying to obfuscate what they do. They're just sort of there. And they often, if done right, are there. The smart defaults, you know, form design, where like we might make a decision for you. That influences your behavior because you might be less likely to find actually the right decision because you'll be like, ah, oh, I don't need that. It's kind of like if you see in, you know, doing TurboTax, it's kind of like, you know, they have these little cues where they ask you something obscure and they tell you like, this doesn't apply to most people. And usually you can go like, yeah, I don't pay taxes on farm animals, so I can move on. But you might just look at that this doesn't apply and you might miss something. But that might be, you know, if they manage that right, that might be rare. But other things, progress indicators, that's trying to influence your behavior by kind of keeping you on the path, but it's also trying to help you so you know where you are. Visualizations, framing things in a certain way, opt-in, opt-out. All these things aren't, you know, hard quantified, and they can all move, right? I mean, opt-in, opt-out can be, you know, really used for evil and dark patterns, and they can also be used for good. Amazon one-click as a feature there, you know, to persuade. And you kind of have in the middle these more ephemeral items that are kind of connecting our sensors and our connectivity, like Pinterest and Facebook. These are what you'd have as sort of like internal mechanisms in thinking about behavior. Like they have like variable rewards and they try to kind of be really sticky. And so internally they sort of want to influence you. But then we could go a long talk about ethics, but really the shortcut in ethics when you kind of use this model is this lower right place. So because if you want to influence someone and persuade someone without offering anything in return, like even Amazon is like, well, I actually want an easy shopping experience, so I actually like it. They obviously want me to buy more, but I like it. If you sit there and go all the way where it's like it's completely in your self-interest and not in the consumer's at all, well, that's going to be manipulation. You manipulate them. And if you don't want to just not announce it like, you know, one click or progress indicator, you actually want to obfuscate what your intentions are, well, then that's deception. And that'll be things like dark pattern opt-ins, like I didn't actually opt into this newsletter, or from a product standpoint, the thing is like, I think I'm getting something for free, and actually I've signed up for something, right? They hid their intention, and then there's no value in it for me from what I'm actually paying for, and so that's where you can do that. This leaves the upper right. The upper right is where sort of, I won't call them new because this type of service or products have existed, you know, smoking cessation, weight loss. It's new relative to our new world of technology and sensors in that in the past 5-6 years, it's really started to explode and become a real focus. Again, the technology close to us makes all these products and services that are about us. I sometimes call this like the new me generation because the things we're now buying now are so much focused on us and our behaviors. And so if you look at that a little bit, if you look at that area, I call that behavior change's value proposition, which really is, you know, hopefully self-explanatory, but I think it becomes different than other types of products that have a different type of value proposition. Products and services designed and marketed on the premise that their benefits, that value exchange, are specific behavioral-based outcomes. And outcomes are essentially like your goal. Like, I want to lose 10 pounds, I want to lower my cholesterol, I want to get out of debt, I want to save. Well, all those things, actually, I won't get to them unless I actually do certain behaviors. And what I really want is a product that will augment my ability to do those behaviors, to help me do those behaviors. And besides this is identifying, there's some key characteristics to sort of know about them so you see in the wild. The first one's obvious, right? This value comes from that behavior-based progress. But then there's also that users self-select into the valprop. If I go back to the cafeteria, that's what they'd call an interventionist method. Like, I didn't decide I wanted a cafeteria arranged so when I go get my lunch. My employer decided to do that for me. They kind of, in a sense, intervened in my life. But when we buy things off the shelf, proverbially, if we download an app or whatever we might do, we're self-selecting. We're saying, I actually want this influence. And that changes a little bit because it changes things like accountability, self-determination. How much can you actually hold people to something when they're sort of like saying, well, I'm paying for this. Maybe I should do it. Maybe I shouldn't. Data collection is a prominent mechanism. Those are the sensors. We have to know what people are doing in order to understand their behavior and influence it. There's that sense of augmented ability. These products are augmenting external behaviors, the things I do out in the world, and behavior change is measurable. But the other important one is that the value proposition is time released. And what that means is most value propositions are what you'd call off-the-shelf, you know, out-of-the-box value proposition. I get my iPhone, I sync it up, and I can use it. I can get on the web, I can download apps, right? If I put a Nest on my wall, or if I put a Fitbit or a Jawbone on my wrist, or I download an app for my budgeting, I think, well, I got something cool, and that feels like the value proposition, a sexy thermostat or a really cool wristband, right? But the value proposition is actually that goal. I want to lose pounds, I want to get fit, I want to get out of debt, I want to lower my energy bill. And that's not going to happen out of the box. That's going to happen in a week, in a month, in a year. And I don't know if we've cracked the nut of understanding that, because that also exists in a lot of the things we do in the world in financial services. I know from my workshop, there's a ton of financial services here, and how people achieve their goals in healthcare, in government, in a lot of even smaller ways. We have to understand, like, yeah, the thing we might offer might not actually pay off out of the box. And what does it mean to sort of show and validate the value proposition as you go? Know that it's not just like the thing you technically get off the shelf, whether it's an app you download or a physical device you wear. Then there's internal influence. Those are the Snapchats and Facebooks. And again, recognizing this in the wild, for better or worse. So I don't know if you've ever heard of Nir Eyal and his book Hooked, but he talks about sort of these internal mechanisms that happen, like, you know, the trigger, the action, the thing you do, but is ideally making it like a very simple behavior, like sending an image or scrolling through a stream. A reward, so even the idea of like, I'm going to scroll through my stream just to find the right update or the right image is actually this idea of variable reward. Where can I find it? An investment, like what can I do when I start using this after a while? You know, in old-timey days, we'd call that being sticky and increasing switching costs and all that stuff, but it is the idea that I've invested in it, so I'll keep using it. This can seem really manipulative, and most of those products and services don't always do this in such an explicit way, but the mechanisms are there, and you can use this for really altruistic reasons. Let's say you want to help somebody get out of debt, or you want to help them get fit, and you know in order to do that, you need them to be engaged in an interface or an app, so you might need to apply some of these sort of internal influences to get them to keep engaged with the app in order to get the benefit of what the app will give them as far as their external behaviors. Those external behaviors of having an ability to do something else, like actually run 3 times a week or pay down my credit card faster. So thinking about those now as a setup, you know, in what way can we think about our capacity as designers to leverage that, ideally responsibly but effectively, but at least at the very most more awares, so to speak. And so interaction design is a particularly good discipline in which to think about it. I mean, this exists across, but interaction design, it tends to be thinking about behavior, mediating behavior, shaping behavior, in some way thinking about the behavior of a system. And then that behavior often is designed to help people reach their goals. So we already know we want to reach their goals. We already know behavior change is often about achieving goals. So I think there's a lot of ways we can leverage the things we have as discipline to make the connections between all this academic theory and the research that exists and actually think about then how to make that leap to be more aware and more cognizant and more rigorous in how we apply it in our work. And a little simple framework I use that I think can apply in elsewhere, but I often use from the behavior changes value proposition is collection, story, and communication. And that's really thinking about the data and the sensors and what our abilities are to understand people's behavior. It's the framing and anchors, leveraging some stuff from interaction design and design in general to understand how we can take this data and turn it around into something that's a prompt and is actionable. And then what is our capacity to actually then, in a sense, intervene? What are the feedback and feed forward things that we can do? And to break that down a little bit, we can start with the data and sensors. And again, I already talked about what we have, our ability. We have all these sensors we now have: biometric, image capture, RFID, accelerometers, GPS. On our wrist, we can get heart rate, we can get galvanic skin response, we can know whether people are perspiring, we can do all blood pressure. And so we have these sensors, and that's really powerful stuff. But we also have our attitudes and our perceptions about this stuff, which is going to be things like our profiles, our status updates, our shared credentials. I remember a big deal in whatever it was, 2005 or thereabouts, when a product like Mint came out. Oh, are people going to use this? Because you have to give them all your passwords and your usernames. I don't know if they'll do it. Now, we don't even hesitate to that. So our attitudes and our actual behaviors around our privacy, which we're happy to exchange if the value proposition communicates with us, has also changed. So we think about that when we think about data collection and understanding sensors and how we can leverage those things. When I first talked about this stuff 5 years ago, I said if it can be connected, it will be connected, and that time has passed, right? It is going to be connected. Connected clothes, connected basketballs, connected cups to analyze your liquids, it's all going to be connected. Connected to our car, so our behaviors around driving, whether we're using too much fuel, too little fuel, going too fast, braking. You know, I talk about getting closer to us physically. I mean, we're really getting to this point where we're going to be, you know, on our person, and it's going to be physically. We can think about our behaviors and health by having sensors that are literally on our eyeball. And then framing and anchors, again, employing some things, you know, really core to interaction design, and thinking about, we get all this data, but getting the data is really half the battle. Matter of fact, people really don't want a relationship with their data. They want to achieve behavior-based goals. So collecting the data in their mind is just a means to an end. They didn't say, like, I really want this information. And so what happens is they get all this information, and they have to do their own little cognitive load of, like, okay, I walked 7,000 steps. Is that good or bad? All right, I actually climbed this many stairs. Is this good or bad? Burn this many calories. I don't know. Is this good or is this bad? And then, you know, my average heart rate was 62 beats per minute or something like that. Is that good or bad? This is cognitive load. This is calculations. And the whole reason we have computers is so that they would do the math for us. And then we have to say, like, of all these variables as a whole, is this good or bad? And so, you know, we shouldn't have to do that work. That's going to be the friction that starts to lose it because, you know, we don't care about the data. We care about what the data means. And we also know that math is hard, and we don't want to do it. And computers were actually designed to do it for us. And to talk about how this comes into play and why framing is a really critical point to thinking about this, I'll go through a little case study in a book called How We Decide by Joan Allaire. And they took two groups of doctors as a study, and they gave these doctors a hypothetical scenario that the Asian flu is going to hit, and, you know, left unattended, it's going to potentially kill 600 people. So they want to see what course of action would you take if you were given two options, two courses of action to potentially take. And the first group was given one where the option A, you take this option, well, then you're guaranteed that 200 people will be saved of those 600 people. If you go to option B, you're going to have a third probability that 600 people will be saved, so a third that all of them will be saved, and about two-thirds probability that no one will be saved. So you're dealing with the odds. The second group had two options. In option A, 400 people will die. In option B, a third probability no one will die, and two-thirds probability that 600 people will die. Now, you probably notice that technically these are the same options, right? They were framed in different ways. And there's a couple things that are going to go on. One is the idea of, like, loss aversion. Well, you know, that's very certain. I can save 200 people versus, like, that's kind of scary. 400 people will die. And so if we look at the results, there was about 72% picked option A and 28% picked option B in that first one. And in the second one, it was almost completely reversed. And it's not just that sort of certainty of who and the loss aversion. There's also a little bit of, like, am I even going to bother? You know, the cognitive load here, I'm going to go with the certain. If the certain is someone's going to die, I'm going to avoid that. If the certain is that someone's going to live, I'm going to go with that. It isn't graphic design. It isn't necessarily, you know, a glowing leaf on your thermostat, but that is framing. That is, like, actually, you know, the power of it. I've seen other examples that are really novel, like, you know, if I gave you two beef patties and I said one was 75% lean and one was 25% fat, which one are you going to pick, right? You're going to pick the lean one. But this shows, you know, when we're talking about people's lives, how powerful it is for people to have something framed and actually influence their behavior, their chosen course of action. And so how do you add meaning to that data? Another example of framing coming from David McCandless, fairly famous Guardian set of infographics. You know, who spends the most? Who prioritizes military the most, right? So the obvious one might be, well, who spends the most? Well, that's the U.S. by a long shot. Matter of fact, all those little boxes are to scale relative to the big box, and they all fit in it. what if we actually think about it by who spends the percentage of the money that they actually have, like their GDP? So who's prioritizing from of like how much money relative to all the money they have? Well, that's going to be Myanmar. And then you have, of all the people that they could have in the military, who has the most people in the military? Well, that's going to be North Korea. I'm not making any editorial value against any of these, but I'm showing how you have this data set that can be shown in different ways to tell different stories, just like editing a documentary film. So the power of framing, the power of anchoring to something, anchoring to like numbers, anchoring to visuals. Then we have the idea of feedback and feed forward. And you probably are all really familiar with feedback, and hopefully some of you are kind of familiar with what, or can at least infer what feed forward means. So feedback, the thing about feedback is you probably understand what that means, right? You get a little notification in the email that says, yes, your email was sent. Ah, okay, that was feedback that said I completed my task successfully. We take for granted our power for feedback, to deliver feedback in real time or near real time right now. And as an example, a couple years ago, I was watching the show Mad Men, and in it, you know, it's about this advertising executive, Don Draper. He had this wife, and this season she was an ex-wife, and the actress that played her was pregnant, and they added prosthetics, and they wrote into the role that she was gaining weight. And she was a very Stepford wife and had been a foreign model, so she had a lot of vanity relative to her appearance, so this affected her a lot. So she joined Weight Watchers, right? And Weight Watchers, they still sort of operate very similarly in that you join a group on a weekly basis, you get weighed sort of Bigger Loser style and to see how much you lost or gained. And in the 60s, personal scales were large and expensive, so you really didn't have those, and those in general people weren't as health conscious about that anyway. So this was a feedback loop, right? Once a week feedback loop that she opted into to know all the behaviors and decisions, the effect of them. So instead of saying like, you know, I ate something and I actually know that that takes 600 calories, you know, once a week you have that feedback loop. And now we know we can get instantaneous feedback loop and we can combine that feedback on our weight with other information and get other feedback loops as well. And this has worked in other ways, right? 30 years ago, most of you guys, you know, some of you guys have never even had a check register. If you wanted an insight and feedback loop into your finances, well, you manually recorded everything, you reconciled it with a statement, so you had sort of a once a month feedback loop to see where you stood in your finances. And then, you know, spreadsheets help you, like, you know, do some of the load and be more accurate, get that feedback loop tightened up, and then off-the-shelf software like Quicken and Money add some framing for you, so the feedback loop there, and maybe they even connect it to the internet, so you might get quicker feedback loop. And now we know I can swipe my card and my phone will buzz with feedback loop. And what's interesting is this is an opportunity, is it buzzes with the fact that I spent $50. Why doesn't it buzz with, like, what that means for me? It doesn't buzz and add meaning to that data. But nonetheless, we're closing that feedback loop, and it's almost easy to take for granted the fact that we have that capacity now. But feed forward is really interesting, and feed forward is the smarter we get, the more we can actually guide people on what would happen if you took certain behaviors, right? That Amazon one click, again, what you see is a feed forward. If you order this in 8 hours, you will get this on Thursday for free. If I click this button, there's feed forward that will tell me this will arrive for free, no charge, by Thursday, or I can feed forward and say it could arrive by Wednesday for $4. But, you know, with all these sensors and data, feedback loops are inherently limited. They have a cap because when we're thinking about people's behavior, what happens is if once I engage in the behavior, I get the feedback loop. That means I'm getting information about my behavior after I actually did it already. So we want to get smarter. We collect data and we can be intelligent and you get geolocation and stuff. And eventually, we can start to instead head that off and get people the behavior that they might want to do before they engage with it versus telling them whether they did a behavior after the fact and that was good or bad. A little analogy I use is that, you know, I kind of know and think about the psychology stuff and irrational choices, and yet I still go into the sandwich shop and I order the salami sandwich and I get a soda and I go to the front of, and I'm at the register and I went in thinking like I don't want the cookies, but then I see the cookies and I buy the cookies and I know better and I even know like I'm not supposed to be doing this, right? And I get the cookies. So what happens if I go into the sandwich shop and my watch or my phone buzzes and I look at it and it tells me, well, you usually do this, but you set some goal in some system, and we're going to tell you this is what would happen. This is the feed forward of what you would do if you did this behavior. But you've got to also do this behavior, and this is feed forward if you did this. And now they've framed it for me, and they foregrounded it for me. So something that seems sort of abstract, like, oh, I'll worry about the calories later, has become more tangible, and it can influence my behavior. And feed forward exists. You look on your credit card statement, it says, well, if you pay minimum payment, this is what you're going to do. If you pay more than minimum payment, this is what you're going to do. Imagine this sort of more dynamic sitting in your pocket, buzzing you at certain points so that you actually are thinking about it. It exists, but who looks at their statement and actually thinks about this? So let's talk a little bit quickly about what we make. There's a case study in here I'm going to cut through for time so we can take questions, but I want to talk about it now in our process. This is a very generic version of process. Design Council started to promote the Double Diamond about 10 years ago, I think, and the idea is we flare out because we want lots of inputs, right? That's the first part of Diamond. We make sense of all those inputs, so we come in there, and then we want to make the leap, so we often produce artifacts that help us make sense of that and help us push us forward, like personas and mental models and journey maps and diagrams and models and insights and principles. And then we move in and we think about, what could we do, right? We open up again, and then we think, like, what do we actually want to do? Let's prototype it, let's deliver it. So that's kind of the general thing. And we can sit there and think about behaviors, like if we think, oh, okay, if we're modeling what behaviors actually exist, we can start to break down what those behaviors are and what the acts. And there's all kinds of things, even in a physical service like this, that has feedback, feed forward, framing, and anchoring opportunities. And then we can sit there and think about testing those behaviors in real time. Again, all those things. I'm going to go through this because I do not want to take too much time in the prototyping, but this is a project where we really thought through this from a behavioral economic problem. But in research, we do a lot of activities, and we can sort of just think about, you know, and we're often after, what are people feeling, thinking, and doing? And that's kind of our goals in when we're doing research, what's happening there. We can start to take things from the psychological side of things and start to apply those as a lens through our research. We can actually understand knowledge, right? I mean, if I don't know much about something I should be doing, like if I didn't know recycling existed, I might not want to recycle. Once I understand what recycling do, some people are going to want to recycle. What is their motivation? And in what way, we also call it, what are their motivational waves? So like when I talked about the Red Cross, you know, I'm intrinsically motivated to donate to something or not donate to something, and that's hard to move. But if I'm kind of motivated to do something, there are times when I'll be more motivated, right? When I'm seeing the images and I'm prompted when I'm watching the TV, and then less times when I'm at home and I'm checking my mail and I'm walking my dog. So we think about their motivation, we think about their ability. What is their actual ability, right? Can I donate to the Red Cross right now or can I not? You can look in the research and understand, like, well, they say they want to be doing something. Are we looking at what their capacity to actually do it is? What are their doubts and barriers, also called FUDs, fears, uncertainties, and doubts, that might be holding them back? And so is that something you can design to address, like the security issues when Mint first started? Well, we have to address that. We have to make people feel secure about giving us their thing. Self-efficacy is a thing. This is like, what is their belief that they could actually do the behavior? Even if my wife buys me an activity tracker, do I have a sense that I would even be able to increase my steps or run 3 times a week or change my diet? Can you design to address that belief so that people feel that sense of self-efficacy, that sense of ability to actually engage it? In strategy, you might think about where, when we do things like journey maps and experience maps and look at things, you know, people's behavior over time and space, and actually understand, like, can we identify when those motivational waves are? Can we identify when those abilities are? Can we look at where we can collect feedback so we can be smart, the sensors? Where are the opportunities to actually foreground something to be framed? This is where we're developing empathy and understanding and crafting our insights. Ecosystem mapping. So I talked about how we have little influence over their environment, but it doesn't mean we don't have any. And we should also still understand the environment so that we can understand where we might influence their perception of the environment, their navigation of the environment, or their interactions with the environment, if we can't actually do the environment. So understanding the world they live in, the things they interact with might be like your app and your service. What does that mean? Well, if it's an app for financial services for checking, well, it means that it probably exists in an app of other financial services, which exists in a world of a larger financial service industry, which exists in a world of either cultural influences or regulatory influences. The more we can understand this and developing that empathy, understanding, and insight, especially the context of the environment, the more we can understand how we can leverage either the environment or that perception, navigation, or interaction with the environment. And then, again, we can sit there and think, what has more direct influence and what has less direct influence? And then there's a method called backcasting that I've sort of hacked for kind of thinking about behavior change and behavior change outcomes. So backcasting is opposite of forecasting. It's basically saying, what is our target state? It could be even like, we want our target state to be that more people that should have life insurance have life insurance. It can apply to like general products and services, not just the behavior change's value proposition. So what is the process? We want people to be happy with the tools they're using, whatever. Or what is the outcome? And then let's actually backcast what the things are that have to occur to get to that outcome. So you're doing that. And I use kind of a random acronym, but it kind of breaks down the components of thinking about badcasting. And this is kind of what it looks like, really. It's just a little like workshoppy method where you look at potential outcomes. You could have this inverted, too, where you have multiple current states and you go to a single state. There's no real rigor to it. It's a matter of just, you know, really defining that future state and then looking at the anatomy of the path to get there what behaviors have to occur, what things in the environment have to occur, what influences have to be changed, things like that. So OBI stands for outcome, behaviors, and interactions, and this is how we get to, like, we're not designing outcomes and we're not designing behaviors, right? So what we think about when we backcast is what we want to do is identify the outcome, those future states achieved by behaviors. So we want to determine that, that's the O, and in determining that, when we understand the outcome, we can sit there and truly say, like, what behaviors have to occur? You know, very similar, but lowering your cholesterol, getting more fit, and losing 10 pounds are all technically different outcomes, so they might have different behaviors to them. So we can identify the behaviors in order to get to that outcome. And then the thing we can actually design are the interactions. We can design that to know, like, what can we do to help somebody do that? And then we can leverage anchoring, we can leverage framing, we can leverage feedback, feed forward, we can collect data, we can leverage other elements in design, but those are the things we're actually designing. So the moment we truly have very crisp behaviors that we want to help support people do, even those could be within traditional products or services, like help people communicate with their team, help people acquire a product that they want to acquire, we can understand how we design the actual interactions or the actual touch points for those behaviors. Insight combination is another very simple ideation method. So if you have those behaviors, then you have all these patterns. Insight combination developed by John Kolko is really the idea of saying, we have these insights about people. Like, people want to do this. People don't like this. Then we have these patterns, and those could be small patterns like tabbed navigation and swiping for interactions. And you kind of, as an ideation, you kind of force combine them. You're like, well, I'm going to randomly pick an insight and randomly pick a pattern and put them together. In this case, around behaviors, there's a ton of behavioral patterns that you can use, like social proof, the idea that I might do something that I see other people engaging in. Interlocking, the idea that things will only work in a certain order, which means it's going to force your behavior to go in a certain way. So you can use it, so you can take your insight, like the thing you know about people's behavior that you might have done in your research, and you can take that and you can mix that with the design pattern. You know, in this case, it could be like the sharing economy, like, okay, Uber for this insight, and you force mix it. And then you time box that ideation, so like for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So thinking about this from behavior, there's all these places you can get insight into behaviors, like the social proof and the interlocking and set completion, the idea that if I got 3 out of 4 things, I'm going to have this little internal mechanism that makes me want to get that fourth thing. Dan Lochten has this design with intent toolkit. It's downloadable PDF cards that you can get that has a lot of these. Stephen P. Anderson, mental note cards, has these. Fabrique is a French design firm that has these more for, like, if you're more in the graphic design and visual design world, so, you know, gestalt theory and color theory and how that affects behavior. Cialdini, he's a professor emeritus at Arizona State. He wrote a book called Influence in the 90s, very marketing-oriented, but he has these weapons that influence. But if you read them, they sound very sinister and marketing-oriented, but social proof is there. Commitment and consistency, that idea that if you commit to something, you might be more likely to follow through with it, which means, like, if I tell myself, I want to do the couch to 5K. All right, I might do it. If I post on Facebook, I'm going to do the couch to 5K. Maybe you'll support me. I'm more likely to do it because I've committed out loud to it and people know it and I've got this internal mechanism of consistency. Liking, scarcity, we see scarcity. Like, hey, you know, be on the list. You're 40,000 in. And like, oh, I got to get down. If you invite a friend, you can jump the list a little further. Like, ah, oh, I want to, you know, invite a friend so I can jump the list because this thing is scarce and I should get a part of it. So they're very powerful. So you collect these things. You understand what, again, this is the making the leap between what we know about behavior and the actual tactical ways we can apply it in our products and services. And we take this thing. We've, like, done our research and we've identified these insights or about their behavior, or we've identified, you know, from the backcasting what the behaviors are, and we sit there, okay, let's take this behavior and let's take social proof and let's just ideate. And you come up with tons of ideas, but the idea is to be very generative and expansive about it. And then, again, what are the things we have at our disposal? Interaction design elements. Dan Saffer, who he's going to do a great book, Designing for Interaction, talks a lot about the things at our disposal when we're trying to shape behavior or mediate behavior through systems. You know, and the things that we have here that we've already talked about, just the sampling of the things that we should start to make sure we have competency in applying. And so the way I kind of look at our design process is we know that, you know, I kind of almost want to make our double diamond time base. We know at the beginning, we're identifying aspirations, those needs, motivations, and goals. I want to get healthy, and that actually manifests itself in lowering our cholesterol. And at the other end is our ability to actually design something effective, sustainable, and viable to that. And so we can think about that process really as a journey relative to that. And I like what Paola Antonelli says, you know, because we often think about how can designers influence behavior. But, you know, she posed it as we should look at what kind of impact people's behavior should have on design. So we should constantly be seeing what's happening behaviorally and culturally to doing that. And so, again, it can manifest itself in its work. it isn't always about behavior change. It might be about the typical enterprise or consumer products and service we have. But I think if we have more intention in making that leap, you know, and being smarter about the psychology of our end users, we're going to be smarter and more intentional about the things we design. Thank you.
For more information and videos from the UX Immersion Interactions Conference, visit our All You Can Learn library at aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.